Museum of the Moving Image welcomes you to the Pinewood Dialogues Online, an archive of conversations with innovative creative figures in film, television, and digital media. Visit Museum of the Moving Image in New York City or online at www.movingimage.us.
Please welcome Jennifer Jason Lee. I'll just read from the New York Times review, because I think that's the one that everybody waits for with the most anxiety. Janet Maslin said that this was the performance was you portrayed a charismatic, unforgettable heroine, stunningly well played. As she confirms here and also showed with her amazing mimicry in the Hudsucker Proxy, Ms. Lee has lately evolved from a promising young performer to an accomplished actress capable of dazzling surprises. What I want to start just by asking you is, what is it like opening night for a film? I mean, waiting for the reviews and then kind of the feelings around that.
It's nerve-wracking, of course, but I was really proud of myself last night because I've been sick, I've had the flu. And so I went to sleep at 8:30. I didn't go out at 10 o'clock and get the paper, which I thought was really, I was really becoming an adult now. And went to sleep at 8:30 and woke up at 8. And then I'm in a hotel, so the paper was outside. And then I got it, and I was grateful. So, it's nerve-wracking because you've done the work. And you know, whether... I happen to like this film a lot. I really love the movie, but you never know how people are going to respond to it. So,
now you said you felt like an adult now, and one of the things that the New York Times review said was that this is some sort of turning point, that you evolved from a promising young performer to an accomplished actress. I was wondering if you saw this film as some sort of turning point, or if you see what's happening right now with your career as a sort of turning point.
Well, I'm bad with the whole notion of career. Mm-hmm. I just don't think about it. I just feel really lucky to be working, and I hope to keep working. that's about as far as it goes. I mean, you always hope that you get better. Mm-hmm. You don't want to get worse. Mm-hmm. You know. So now is a good time for me, because I've been working a lot, and I have another job now, so that's always very good.
You've actually finished shooting the next two movies after Mrs. Fox already.
Yeah.
What was it like playing an older character, and a character who ages?
That was particularly terrifying until we shot it, because all I could imagine was, you know, when you're in high school and you see a high school play and the person comes out playing the granny and they're all hunched over with a cane, and that was just in the forefront of my brain. And so I called every actor I knew who had done it well. I didn't call the ones who had not done it well, because I didn't want to do that. And then I spent a lot of time with people who were 65, and I went to some bars and watched women at that age drunk. And well, you notice a 65, it ain't that old, you know. Mm-hmm. And so what I really tried to work on was the life that she had experienced from the time we had seen her till then. I mean, there are things you can do with posture and with the way you see the world, but it's also the world that you've seen, and it's sort of the depth of your experience which gives you age, really, more than anything. I mean, at that point, you can still move your head. You can, you know, it doesn't hurt to walk; it just hurts to think. So,
you have said, in talking about the characters you've played and what you get out of portraying those people, that you get to explore sides of life that aren't there in your real personality, or there in so-called real life. So that playing characters with a darker side have let you explore things. I was wondering what Dorothy Parker means to you. Here's somebody, first of all, who's incredibly dark and incredibly opinionated. One thing you've said in interviews is that you don't feel like you're a very opinionated person in real life.
No, and also when I have opinions, I usually don't share them. So that was a great, first of all, she's always been a hero of mine. Mm-hmm. I mean, since I was 16, she was my hero. So that was an amazing thing to play. It was amazing to be inside her brain because she's so brilliant and so funny. And I mean, the sadness I understood. Mm-hmm. And I also, I think that every woman who ever reads Dorothy Parker relates in a very, very deep way.
Mm-hmm. In a lot of the choices that you've made and the roles you've taken, you've played characters who are confronting pain, dealing with pain, and it seems as though you're doing that in a way to get at a sort of honesty of portrayal. And one of the things that typifies Dorothy Parker is that she always told the truth. She was completely
honest.
Yeah,
exactly. And that's another thing I love about her. She told it as she saw it, you know, and she saw things pretty damn clearly. And I just think that's a remarkable quality. She was so smart and so sharp. I have these interviews of hers when she was 65. And the things she said, I mean, aside from the fact that they're howlingly funny, she's just so smart. And she was never afraid to say exactly what she felt. And as harsh as she was on other people, she could decimate people with a sentence. You know, she was that hard on herself, too.
Mm-hmm. You once said that you used to turn off certain emotions. This is for yourself. But cutting them off is something that is about being truly alive, or not cutting them off, I guess. And a lot of being alive is really very painful. And that it's and you also said it's in the strange or the unusual that we find ourselves. So I think this again has to do with some, I think, some of the choices that you made in characters.
Yeah. I mean, I think that I said it. I do think it's true. It's like a movie. I don't know if you all saw Sweetie, but it's one of my all-time favorite movies. Yeah. And you couldn't have odder, stranger characters. Yeah. And you relate to all, you recognize them, you know, whether it's you or your sister or someone else in your family. It's usually someone in your family. But I relate so strongly to that movie, as opposed to movies where the people are really generic and we're supposed to see ourselves, but all we feel is inadequate when we watch them.
I want to talk a little bit about the clips that we saw. So Alan Rudolph it must have been an interesting experience. I think that he's a director who often one has the feeling in his films that you're as a viewer, you're eavesdropping on a real situation. There's a sense that almost like a documentary, like feeling in the way he uses the camera. Mm-hmm. Work. What was that?
That's true, because as an actor you feel that way too, because everyone, we're all wearing these, except you don't see them on the outside as our costumes. But everybody's mic'd, and usually in a film you're not allowed to overlap, so if you speak I have to wait at least a beat before I begin. Mm-hmm. And you have marks on the floor, like these chair marks, so that you can stand, you come to that mark and talk, and then move to another mark and talk. And on Alan's films, everybody's mic's there, so you can overlap whenever you feel like it. There are no marks, so everything is spontaneous. There's a lot of improvisation, which on this was hard, because mm-hmm. we were inside these brilliant minds, you know, which none of us possessed, so we all had really bone up. And but we did, and we had the greatest time of our lives. I mean, we just had so much fun, and you don't know where the hell the camera is. Mm-hmm. And where it's going, because the camera's set up over there, but it's moving all over the place. And so it's incredibly freeing, and every single detail down to the silverware on the table is period. Mm-hmm. You know, so excuse me. So he creates something very, very real. Yeah. And then you feel like you can live it, which is
now
different.
This is a quality that I think is true of a lot of your performances, that you seem to be totally inside the character and just really living that person. And we've heard a lot of your interviews. You talk about the preparation work you do beforehand, but I just wonder what the experience is like when you're actually in front of the camera, and there are lights and microphones. And there was a story I read once about your very first movie, like a Disney TV movie.
Oh, that was horrible.
Where you,
yeah.
where you were, like, kept looking at the camera and then
yeah.
looking at.
It was so big.
So, I mean, what is it like now in front of the camera? Is it truly? I mean, have you truly got to the point?
No, I love it. No, it's no problem. It's just there. Mm-hmm. But when I was, I guess I was 15 or 16 when I did that Disney movie, and I'm so atrocious in it. And it's Phoebe. It's my friend Phoebe's favorite film because I'm so bad. And you can literally see my eyes going from the person I'm looking at to the camera. Yeah. Oh, you want to see it now?
we left it off the filmography.
It's called The Young Runaways. It was a TV thing.
Somebody saw it.
Okay. Oh, no.
Okay. Shortcuts, where you work with one of the very greatest directors, directors. Your character in Shortcuts is one of the few that was not actually from Raymond Carver, that was invented. I mean, this is what I understand, that it was invented.
Well, it's from a Raymond Carver short story, but yeah, that character, obviously they didn't do phone sex back then.
Right.
They weren't paid to do phone sex.
Could you talk about how that character evolved? I mean,
basically, yeah, he called me and he said, what do you think of the character of Lois? Which, in the script, basically said, Lois is on the phone doing a phone sex call. I mean, that's all that was there. And I said, I love it. It sounds great to me. Because it really did. And he said, well, you go out, you find her, you get the phone calls, you do it. I just want it very real and very raunchy. So I thought, perfect. I love that idea. And so I just went to a bunch of phone sex places. There was one that was literally a factory where people were in little cubbyholes side by side. And I think that's where the rubber bands thing, there's a rubber bands thing in an earlier phone sex thing that I got. And then I went to a very private, intimate office. And then I went to a woman's house. And then I went to a man who does it in the valley. He's a heavy metal guitar player. But he had a broken leg, so he couldn't work. And so he needed to make some money. So on the phone, his name, I think, was Candy. And, but it was quite an education, you know. And all the phone calls in the movie are verbatim phone calls that I listened to, some of which I tape recorded, which they didn't care about at all. I mean, I got to go through the files. A lot of people call. I have my next job in the bag. We'll just put it that way.
What is the process of internalizing a character like? Because you do incredible research work and external work, in a way, in terms of getting the physical details. Mm-hmm. But you've talked about how acting is like a virus to you, that or getting a character is like getting a virus. It's something that is in your system and that it's with you throughout the film. So what is that? I mean, how does that transformation work?
I don't know. I do a lot of research. I read a bunch of things, and I meet a lot of people that I think are similar to the character or could be, and pick things from different people. And with Dorothy Parker, there was just tons on her, and that's all I had to focus on. So it was a little bit easier in certain ways. And I use paintings and photographs. On the last movie, I used a lot of Nan Golden and Larry Clark's photography, and different music and things like that, and I just work and pray to God it's going to like sink in somehow. And then I don't know quite how it happens, but at a certain point you have to trust it, you know. And
then does something change when you hear the word action, for example? I mean, Alan Rudolph said that you know, in praising you, he said you're the most anonymous actress that he's ever worked with, that you save it all for the screen, and then it's electrifying when it's on screen. And there was a
That's
similar...
That's nice.
And then Robert Altman, who said that you're the actress who other actresses will someday be judged against, said that off camera you're like a ghost, and that there is some kind of transformation.
I'm very pale, it's true. You know what it is, that I'm shy, you know, and it's hard. I mean, I think acting for me is a way... When I'm in someone else's skin and I'm saying someone else's words and living their life somewhat, it's a lot easier for me, and I'm much freer and more extroverted, and I can communicate. I can communicate something about myself that I wouldn't dare communicate otherwise. And so I think that's, I mean, I often feel like I have very little to say, and I'm awed by Altman, you know, so. I mean, there was a day where he thought I was, when he first came, one day he came to visit the set, and he asked me to get him a cup of coffee, and of course I was delighted. I get to get all my coffee. And so I went and got it and everything, and then someone said that was Jennifer, and he thought I was a production assistant.
Okay, the Coen brothers, who were very different directors, who seemed to be much more interested in surface and externals, and who made fun of you apparently for your research.
Yeah, they call me a sissy.
They said
something.
Research was for sissies.
Yeah. Well, it is in a certain way, but they don't have to do research. You know, they're brilliant. Mm-hmm. They have these. I mean, I don't know how their minds work. I never will understand that. Because they seem so normal when you meet them. They're really, it's just beyond me. So they don't need to do any research, but I do.
Now that movie, The Hudsucker Proxy, is very much a movie about earlier movies that makes one think of His Girl Friday. How much, in this case, how much was your research based on looking at old movies as opposed to going out and talking to journalists? Or?
Yeah, well that's, I mean, I did a little of that realistic. I talked to Murray Kempton, who was great to talk to, and I did a little of that and a little bit about working in a newsroom in the 50s, but the way I approached that was as though I were an actress in the 30s doing a movie for Sturgis or Cukor or any of those, or Capra. And so I read all their bios, and I was able to get sort of gossip magazines with interviews with Jean Arthur and Katharine Hepburn and things like that, and read their bios. And so that's how I wanted to approach it, because it's not, there's no realism in the movie at all, you know. It's a screwball comedy, and I grew up watching those, so I always loved them so much, but I never thought I'd get a chance to make one.
Yeah, you haven't done that many comedies. I mean, some cameo, a small part of the big picture. What is the difference for you between, if there is one, between drama and comedy? You don't think there is in the process?
I think it's all, I mean, I think of Miami Blues as a comedy, too. I mean, it's dark, but it's hopefully funny. But no, I think you approach it the same way. It's a human being, you know, and it's just finding out who that person is. And
you once played a series of prostitutes in different films, and now you seem to be playing journalists in The Hudsucker Proxy. In your upcoming movie, Dolores Claiborne played Esquire, writer. So what kind of empathy do you have for journalists who also do a lot of the same investigative work? I mean, your approach.
Yeah, they do, because I met with, I think, 10 or 12 journalists in New York and in Washington and interviewed them, which was nice. And they were really generous and really open, and boy, do I have the dirt on this town now. I really do. But I have a lot of empathy now. And the frightening thing is, though, is that I did this whole thing, you know, all this research, and I thought, this is going to make me really savvy. And the next time I give an interview, I'm not going to say this, I'm not going to say that, I'm going to be so careful. But the problem was, is because I had all this empathy, the next two interviews that I did was like, whatever you want to know. You know, which was not such a good thing. But, you know.
How important is language for you in writing in terms of creating a character? You've also played, these three roles that we saw were very involved in the use of language. And you apparently write diaries for all
the
characters.
Diaries for the characters I play, in their voice. Just so that when, if I'm in a scene, I can have their memories or what they ate for breakfast or, you know, something their father or mother said to them. So that I have a relationship that's in a memory of mine, that's the characters.
What would you say is this is kind of a hard question, I guess, but the split between, you've said that acting is not cerebral. There's a lot of intellectual work that you do and a lot of in your preparation, but that ultimately it comes from the gut. So, I mean, is there any way to talk about what the split is?
It's not, you know, when you do the prep, it's very cerebral, and a lot of it is physical and practical, like learning to type or learning to shoot pool or whatever you have to do. And that part's fun because it's mindless. But the greatest part of acting is it's so freeing. You're not in you're maybe in the character's head, but you're not in your own head. You're not questioning everything or pondering everything. You're pondering whatever they're pondering, which is a lot of times more interesting than your own thoughts.
Before we open it up to questions, I just want to ask about a few of the earlier films. At about the time you made Last Exit to Brooklyn, this was around when Pretty Woman was made, which was a much different view of a prostitute, and you turned down the role. You were.
I didn't turn down the role.
Okay.
He would never have been interested in me.
Could you talk about why you wouldn't be interested in doing a role like that, like Pretty Woman?
Well, here's an example. When I first read that script, it was a very dark script for Pretty Woman, and I thought, wow, Disney's changing. And I went in to meet, and I'd just done Last Exit, and I thought, gee, should I do another whore? But I thought, I like whores. I think they're really interesting, so what the hell? So, and the script was interesting, so I went and I met him, and he had no interest in me whatsoever. And so I read a scene that was very brief, a little short scene where she comes up to the car, and she says to the guy, you want a blowjob? And he says, how much? And she says, $30 or something. And we read that scene. And he said, all right, I want to try it again. And, you know, she's still really having a good time. She's only done this for about 2 weeks. And I just thought, how much fun is it to get into a car with a 60-year-old guy and unzip his fly and give him a blowjob? Like, how much fun is that, Gary? And I just sort of knew this was not going to be. So, and then of course the movie came out and it was a fairy tale. You know, it's a recruitment film. It's like Top Gun for prostitutes.
Now you did do a movie a few years. You know, one of your first roles that got you a lot of attention, Fast Times at Ridgemont High. Which actually, which we're showing this weekend, so I wanted to plug that. But actually, it's a movie that explores teenage sex, but is able to, for one thing, show real pain and real emotions, but also show it from a woman's point of view. I wonder what you think of that film and what the fact that it was directed by a woman, Amy Heckerling, had to do with it.
I think Amy did a really remarkable job with. You know, with the film, but with the sex scenes in particular, because it's awkward and uncomfortable and sad and clumsy and sweet, but not in a cloying way. And so I think she really caught that. I mean, the scene had to be cut down for the ratings board, which was disappointing to Amy and to me as well. But I think she understood it in a really great way, because it wasn't glamorized or beautified at all. It's an awkward, clumsy, uncomfortable scene.
And in terms of other woman directors you might work with, the obvious one that comes to mind is Jane Campion. So have you?
I'd love to work with her.
Have you ever talked to her about doing a project or met her?
I met her. I was at Cannes when they showed the piano, which was an amazing night to be there. And walking into the party, she was right ahead of me. So I sort of tapped her on the shoulder, and I just told her how much I loved the movie. And that's the extent of my relationship with her.
Okay. Could you talk a little bit about Georgia, which sounds like it must be a personal project, because it was written by your mother. And
Yeah.
Produced by you. So.
I'm one of the producers, yeah. It was an idea that I had. I've always wanted to work with my mother. She's a really, really gifted writer, and I'd always wanted to do a movie about sisters, because I'm very close with both of my sisters, and I always wanted to play a singer, but I don't really have much of a voice. So it's a movie about two sisters, one who has a voice from God, and who's very successful, and very grounded, and has a family, and her younger sister, which is the part I play, Sadie, really doesn't have a great voice and is a complete fuck up, and it's about their relationship, really. Mm-hmm. But Georgia's very contained and has a kind of peace about her, and Sadie has no peace, and she's just like, if there were a brick wall in front of her, she'd go charging into it and get all bloodied and break her nose, and then she'd get up and say, "This time I'm going to get through it," you know, and that's basically the character.
Yeah. Okay. Right down here.
Given that you're shy, I'm wondering what it's like to be living in a fishbowl of Hollywood, that kind of a setting.
Well, you know, I grew up in Hollywood, so it's my home. I have friends from 5 years old who I'm still really close with, and my mom lives, you know, a mile and a half away from me, and my sister lives there too, and so to me, Hollywood isn't some. I don't go to premieres unless I'm in it and you have to go. But I go to movies all the time. But I like to see them when I can have popcorn, and I actually really like nachos, so I like I like to go that way. And so I'll go to movies like 3 times a week, and I'll see my friends and go to dinner, and that's about it. You know, that part of Hollywood I don't see because I don't. It's not that I don't care for it, I just, it doesn't excite me or interest me, or it just makes me kind of uncomfortable, so.
On the subject of your shyness again, how do you feel about doing some talk shows, the Letterman Show, or Lean Leno? Are those things that are a little bit intimidating for you?
Terrifying, yeah. Terrifying.
Show?
I did Letterman a year ago, and he was incredibly nice to me. Thank God. But, and I had to work on that so hard because I was so scared. And also, that studio is freezing. It's really cold. So, but you know what? I got through it. They made me the last one just in case it went really badly so I could cut it short. But, and you're only on for 5 minutes, so it goes by really, really fast. So it went okay, and I liked him, but I don't think other talk shows would. I might do Letterman again because I think he's really funny, and he was really nice to me, which I will repeat. But I don't. The other ones I don't think I could handle. No.
Okay, we're here.
Yeah, I was curious how much prep time you put in for each role, and also whether you prefer to rehearse before shooting. And if you like improvisation,
I love to improvise. I just think it's so much fun, and I do as much prep as I have time to do. Like I'm going to do Kansas City with Robert Altman in April, so this gives me 5 months, which is great. If I could take a year and a half to prep something, I would. If I have 6 weeks. And it's, you know, 12-hour days. I mean, it's a long work day every day. But I love preps. I didn't graduate high school, so for me, it's a really great way to learn, and also just informs me about who this person is. So, yeah. Did I answer all of the questions?
Some actors like to rehearse.
Oh, I like to rehearse. I like it, because then you can fall on your face a couple of times. And you can be really bad and try a bunch of stuff, and you can do that in rehearsal, and then you can find things. But you're not always afforded that. So, but yeah, I like it a lot.
Was there a lot of improv in Mrs. Parker? Because some of the ensemble scenes have the feeling.
Oh, it's a lot of it's improvised. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
done here.
What is it like to watch yourself on screen after you've worked? And have you ever acted on stage, not on screen? If so, what's that like for you?
I did a play in New York probably about 6 or 7 years ago at Circle Rep Sunshine, and I loved it. It was a three-character play. It was a character I really understood and loved playing. And I was always terrified before I got on stage, but once the play started, the nice thing about doing a play is that you get to go from beginning to end, and you get to have that whole experience. Curtain calls were always a little scary. And after the play was over, when I got to L.A., when I got back home, I just thought, I don't know how the hell I did it. I mean, because I loved the experience. But when I got home, I realized I must have been so fucking scared, you know? But, it was a great, great experience for me. I was going to do Simpatica. I was supposed to do that last fall, but then the financing fell through. So now, and then when they got the financing together, I was doing Georgia. So I couldn't do it. The watching myself on screen really depends on what side of the bed I wake up on. I mean, some days I'll go and if I've seen a movie before and I'll see it and I'll just think, God, I'm dreadful in this. What happened? And then I'll see it a week later and I'll think, hey, that was good. I like that movie. You know, so it really, really depends on sort of how I'm feeling that day, I think. But if I have two or three moments that are genuinely alive and where I really see that person as I met them, then I'm happy. If I can just have two or three of those, you know.
Anything? I haven't kicked anybody in the back, so. Back here? Yeah.
There's characters or stories that you really like want to portray if you had, a chance. Any like other heroes or any people that you really want to portray?
That's hard. I loved Bastard Out of Carolina. Did you read that? That I really loved, and I would love to do that, but somebody has the rights already, I think, to that, so. That always happens. You read something, and you go, this I'd love to do, and you call about it, and it's been gone for months and months and months. Yeah, exactly.
Okay, over here.
Yeah, Jennifer, I want to thank you for doing this, because I think you have done exceptional work, and I spoke to author Kim Rosengraff not long ago, and she had high praise for your work in Rush and just your work in general. And in movies like Rush and Undercover, you were more, a lot has been said about your victim roles, but you had basically tough cop roles in those movies.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see yourself doing any more of those roles, more action-oriented?
It's hard for me to... If I read something, when I read a script, I always, it's not a cerebral process. I either want to play that person inspires me and is exciting to me, or I don't. And I don't know, for example, I definitely want to do this, that's why I always say I can't speak about career because I don't understand it, or it's not a word that is really in my consciousness, it's just not. But if I read something that had a character like that, yeah, I'd love to. Kim is great, by the way.
Yes.
Say, are you friends with her?
You talked about not being happy with Backdraft.
Yeah, that's the one. I didn't want to mention it by name.
A certain Ron Howard film. But you seem to have stayed away from kind of big, glossy... certain type of big glossy commercial mm-hmm. Hollywood project. You talked about not being interested in A League of Their Own, which had a lot of roles for women.
Right.
But I guess if you could talk about some of the roles you've avoided or what, like why you don't wind up in these big megabuck productions.
Well, if you watch Backdraft, you'll know why I avoid them. not because of the movie or Ron Howard, who I like a lot. Mm-hmm. It's just that I I'm terrible in them. I can't connect to them at all. And I tried everything. I mean, all the research in the world could not save me in that. And no matter, you know, everybody, a lot of people were saying to me, you should do a woman like this. You've never done anything like this. And now we know why.
Okay, right here.
Jennifer, you get so involved in your roles. Which movie did you see as a child do you think probably set you on your course to act?
Well, I saw a lot of movies when I was really little that I loved. Forbidden Games, which is such a beautifully great film. And a lot of the old movies I really loved. And then when I was 14, I saw Dog Day Afternoon. And that sort of changed my life in a way. I mean, I certainly did school practically every day to see. I saw that movie 17 times. And every time I had to get someone in line to buy me a ticket because it was R-rated. But it just had so much energy, and the characters were so interesting and so tortured and yet full of hope. And so that was one of, at 14, I think that was the movie that inspired me the most.
Okay, over here.
Was there any role that you were up for that you really wanted but still worked out on?
Well, sure. I desperately wanted to get in on the piano. I was shooting Rush at the time, and I was shooting every day, so I couldn't fly in to meet Jane Campion. But the truth is that when I saw the movie, I loved it so much, and I think Holly Hunter is so unbelievably brilliant in that movie that just felt lucky to be sitting there watching it, you know? And that's sort of the best feeling when you lose something or when you don't get a chance to even meet or read for something, you know? I mean, I just loved being able to see that movie, and there wasn't a moment of, oh, I still wish I had done it. I don't wish I had done it. I'm glad I got to see her do it, you know? And then when you go and see a movie where you really wanted it and you see it and it's not very good, and then you think, eh, it's not so good. So, no big loss.
Okay, down here.
I'm curious to know how you have this reputation for researching so thoroughly, how it affects the people that you're going to be working with. Are they intimidated? Like, oh no, I have to work with Jennifer. I haven't done it.
Oh no. I hope not. You know, and I don't think so at all. First of all, acting is a really weird thing, you know? I mean, it's nothing, there's nothing tangible about it. You can go down to the village and get some guy out of a grocery store and he could give the most brilliant performance you've ever seen. I mean, it's just, and everybody works differently. I mean, some people do no research, some people look at the script the day they get there, some people do more research than I do, you know? And I just think that everybody has their own way of going about it, and that's the great thing about acting, you know. And about, well, you can't do that on stage, but it, certainly in movies, it's a very funny thing in that way.
Do you ever wish that you could do it like the guy in the grocery store? No,
sure. I mean, well, Joel and Ethan said to me one day, if we ever work with you again, you're not going to be allowed to do any research. So yeah, sure, I'd try it. You know, but I love doing research because, like I said, you know, it's a way for me to learn, and then I can always draw from the truth. And the truth of the matter is, I couldn't come up with, I mean, certainly in Shortcuts, that stuff, that. I could never have come up with that. I mean, I witnessed that, you know. So there are things that you, in life, that are true, but if you don't have that experience and you don't know it, you could just never come up with it in a million years, I don't think. And it's much more interesting and strange than, I think, what your imagination, because your imagination is built on your experience in a certain way.
Okay, right here.
You see a lot in papers and articles about there not being very many good roles for women, but you seem to have had a lot of brave, substantive roles, and I wonder what you think of that criticism, if you want to have highly because you've avoided some of the big Hollywood movies.
Mm-hmm. I think there aren't that many great roles for men either, frankly. And I think I'm lucky in that the stuff that appeals to me, I have odd taste, and it doesn't appeal to a lot of other people. And I just like what I like, and I'm lucky in that I'm able to find stuff that I want to do, and every once in a while the person who's doing it wants me to do it too. So... yeah, but I don't think there are that many good parts out there. And certainly not in the big, big films.
Have you been getting better choices in the last few years? I mean, you, after Single White Female and Rush, which were your first real, like, pure kind of star, mm-hmm. starring role vehicles, you've worked with the Coen brothers and Robert Altman and Alan Rudolph.
Yeah, life's changed a little bit.
But are there... I mean, is there more to choose from now?
Well, what's lucky now is I'm getting to make movies that I actually want to go see. Mm-hmm. So, things are easier, and I do get scripts and scripts that I like and that I want to do. Mm-hmm.
And we haven't really talked about Dolores Claiborne, but that was the film that you shot before Georgia.
Before Georgia.
Could you talk about that a bit?
That's with Kathy Bates, mm-hmm. and I play her daughter, and we haven't seen each other for 15 years. And the character I play is a journalist. She's also addicted to alcohol and prescription pills, and she has a tremendous amount of rage. It's the kind of person that if she walked into a room and you were in the room, you'd either want her to leave or you would leave because she's not a nice person to be around. And through the course of the film, and she loathes her mother. Just being around her mother just makes her back go up. And she doesn't really know why she is the way she is, but she's very defended against finding out. And through the course of the film, she discovers really what happened to her in childhood. And that her mother, who she's been hating all these years, a lot of that hatred is really towards the father, who's dead. But she doesn't, you know, in her mind, she's made him the kind of hero and her this horror.
Okay. Over here.
Is there anybody you've seen who you either want to work with, like a Quentin Tarantino?
Yeah.
Or another actor again, and you worked with before, or didn't have a scene with, like, Fast Times, you worked with Sean Penn, but you had no interaction?
Sure, I'd love to work with Sean Penn, yeah. Sean Penn I'd love to work with. I'd love to work with Alec again. I had a great time working with him, yeah. Oh, good! Yeah, we had a really good time. There are a lot of actors who I'd love to work with, most of the cast with Dorothy again. It was just an amazing group. I think Gwyneth Paltrow is quite something. I think she's really amazing. I'd love to work with Julia Lewis again. We were in Crooked Hearts together, but we didn't really have anything to do together. Yeah, and as far as directors, I'd love to work with Mike Lee. I'd love to work with Jane Campion. I'd love to work with Woody Allen. Scorsese, of course. Who wouldn't?
Okay. Over here.
I thought the Hollywood Grandview USA about 10 years ago, which never seemed to find its audience. I wonder what you recollect about making that movie. And then also, how did your parents influence, your family influence your acting and your choice to do it?
I like Grandview. I had a good time doing it. I liked that part a lot. It was fun. It was fun for me. I had a really embarrassing incident happen right when I was going there, and the character's into sort of kinky sex and... So I bought all these really disgusting magazines, you know, that with these really graphic, horrific pictures that you just don't want those images in your brain, you know. And so I bought them, and they were in my suitcase in the zipper pocket. And unfortunately, there were like 7 of them. And as I was going through the airport dragging the suitcase, the zipper was unzipped and all of these flew out. And there was this like 6'4 porter who scooped them all up. And I didn't even know. I was just sort of trying to race to the plane. He said, Miss? You dropped D's. That was really horrible. Horrible. But I had a good time. I also had a root canal during the shoot of that movie. I just went in for a cavity, and 2 hours later he said, "Hey, I performed a root canal on you." But and there were women lined around the block for Troy Donahue, lined around, literally, to get his autograph and whatnot.
What was Kleiser like as a director?
He was very sweet. He was funny. Yeah, he was a nice. It was the whole feeling on the shoot was very, very nice.
Okay, over here.
Yeah, I saw a proxy about 2 weeks ago, obviously on video. Why do you feel the film didn't seem to reach an audience? It seemed like a terrific send-up of the Frank Capra film. It was very funny, and it didn't go anywhere.
I don't know, you know, I love it. I mean, I go to the first matinee of all their movies, so for me to even be able to read that script was a huge, huge deal. And then to get to meet them was even a bigger deal, and then I got it, so it was just, the whole thing is unbelievable. But I love the movie, but I never know what makes anyone go see anything, ever. And I always feel just, if I like the movie, I just feel lucky to have made it and sort of call it a day. Because you have no control over that aspect of it. I mean, it would have been nice if people had gone to see it. That would have been great, but I guess it didn't. I don't even know how well it did, how well it didn't do. I don't keep reading those kinds of things.
You have talked in a lot of interviews about your older sister, but getting a lot from her in terms of your acting and your approach to acting. I just wanted to make sure we touched on that a bit, so you could.
Sure.
Yeah.
Carrie is 3 years older than me, and she was all gut growing up. You know, if she felt something, she didn't say it; she screamed it, and She's incredibly inspiring to me as a person. She's probably the most courageous person I know. I mean, she's lived so many lives that are so tough and hard and extreme. I mean, she really lived on the edge for a very, very long time. And she's also probably the most generous person I know, and in a funny way, the most grounded, because she's just lived so much. And we're really close, and we were, growing up, we were just opposite ends of the spectrum. Mm-hmm. But she did all those, I really think that my personality largely is formed sort of in reaction to Carrie. And I think she's also probably one of the people that I admire most in this world, really.
We have time for just a few more questions. So, there's one over here.
In Single White Female, you played a shy, introverted character. Was that, in a sense, easier for you to play than something like a...
She was psychotic. Yeah. That was... Yeah, she was introverted isn't, I don't know how introverted she was. I think she was, you know, she fell in love at first sight, basically. I mean, here's this woman, she wants to be her, she wants to merge with her, she wants to possess her, you know. So it's, how do you go about that? How can you be that? How can you get this person to complete you and let you in? So it's more about, you know, making sure the ground is steady, because you want to stay there, and you want to make the right impression. You don't want to freak her out. You don't want to lose her. You want to get the apart. You want to live there.
Was there research for that role?
Oh, tons. Yeah, tons. I got to meet two
twins.
Twins that had been hospitalized for having trouble with merging and separation. They both tried to commit suicide, and I mean, they obviously didn't murder anyone, but they had threatened people, and they just couldn't, without the other one, they just felt, the boy said, it was, they were fraternal, and the boy said that when he separated from his sister, he felt as though his, they had been connected, like Siamese twins, and that she had been severed from him, but they hadn't sewn him up. And so that his guts and entrails were just, you know, spilling out onto the floor all the time. That's how he felt. And I talked to therapists, and there's so many books on borderline personality, which is what Hedy was, I think. Although more on the psychotic end of borderline than the neurotic end of borderline. But,
okay, back here.
I met with a bunch of streetwalkers and spent time with them, and I read a lot about the 50s and that period in America, and I used a lot of George Gross paintings, so I had my wall sort of plastered with them, and also pictures of New York in that period, and I watched movies that she would maybe have seen one or two of those movies playing, you know, and you know, basically, and read the book a bunch of times and talked to Hubert Selby a lot, and the music from the period too.
Okay, down here.
What did you, when you researched Dorothy Caulfield, what did you discover about her psychological makeup?
Well. She was very complicated. She was incredibly myopic, but she almost never wore her glasses, and I don't think it was out of vanity. I think it was because she just saw things too clearly, and it softened the world. And I think the alcohol did the same thing for her. And she had just the most miserable love life. And I think the mother dying at such a young age always makes you feel that you're about to be abandoned, and it's your fault. Because she felt, I think, somewhat responsible for her mother's death, because her mother was 42 when she was born. So I think that had a lot to do with it. I think the fact that it was so painful for her to write, that she was known for fluff and for her witticisms, and she wanted to be thought of as a great writer. She said, I don't know, I don't have the whatever it is to write a novel. That's what she said. And the other thing, the other kind of amazing thing she said was, I'd like to do good work, and someday I hope to. I haven't done it yet. And this was at 65. She had written Horthy, she had written the, you know, Blonde, she had written Lovely Leave, Soldiers of the Republic, she'd written the best-selling volumes of her poetry. I mean, and her poetry is so amazing. And I don't think she was being humble when she said this. I mean, the first time you listen to this interview that I have, you think, come on, there's just no way she could be saying this about herself. But you realize after listening to it a couple times, she means it. You know, she said, no writer ever puts down on his page what he really meant to be there. And that's the curse of all writers.
Okay, well, we're going to have to end on Dorothy Parker instead of Dogs and Prostitutes. So I think we found a good closing point.
Very good.
I want to urge people to go out and see the movie, of course. And very much thanks, Jennifer, Jason Lee, for being here tonight.
Thank you for listening. The Pinewood Dialogues at Museum of the Moving Image are made possible by generous support from the Pannonia Foundation. To learn more about the museum, visit www.movingimage.us.